Why are there so many ads about spark plug and how they roast their beans? Spark plug is special, and why should you settle for stale mediocrity? They offer quality blends of variety, regular delivery. Someday we'll find it, the spark plug connection, the lovers of coffee and me.
Oh, Bevy.
That's right. Spark Plug starts with premium fair trade Arabica beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf and a rotating seasonal blend for those of you that like to shake it up. But the best part is that Spark Plug delivers this fantastic coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You can order Spark Plug as you need it, or join the Spark Plug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible and comes with all kinds of member benefits. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word with the number 100, Spark Plug is now offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Move right along to sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Yes, sir. And thank you for downloading the Next 172 Project, the classic movies podcast that once reviewed the AFI's greats from their 1998 and 2007 lists. That was a hoot, but now we tackle movies of all types. And we spoil those movies we cover then and now. Thoroughly. I'm the professional who's had three performances and prefers to be in his natural habitat, a Studebaker, Ryan Ellis. And here's the blonde diva who kicks more heavy-duty booty than Bruce Lee or Cliff Booth. Little Tarantino reference from earlier this year. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
Who sure can sing a coffee sponsor.
Well, I can try. I don't know how in tune I am.
Connection. The imbibers. The drinkers and me of coffee. Probably not in tune there either. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's fun movie, The Muppet Movie. Who is the best Muppet and who's the best of the guest stars in this picture? I think these are empirical facts, but let's generously call this a quote-unquote opinion question.
Well, I'll start with the second part of the question first, because I know we agree on that, because this is an objective fact. Steve Martin is the best guest star in the movie, bar none, head and shoulders, better than everybody else combined. His scene is hysterical and perfect, and every touch about him, down to his costume, is so funny.
Are you Miss Piggy? I don't know, is she?
And then the first part, I honestly am surprised that there is anybody in the world that has a favorite Muppet that is not Gonzo.
Really? Gonzo's your choice?
Gonzo's the best one!
Gonzo with the Muppet Babies, I might agree with you. But the grown-up Muppets, never was a huge fan of Gonzo. I don't know what the difference is, but I always loved him.
You're so dead wrong.
Muppet Babies. My choice, of course, is the funny, furry, fabulous Fozzie Bear.
What do you love about Fozzie?
I think this movie is a great example of why, because he's always like this, I guess, in all the movies and the TV show and everything. But in this movie, he's not funny, but that's funny. When he first comes out, waka, 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 honk, 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 constantly, such lame comedy. Reminds me of what Bruno Kirby does in Good Morning Vietnam, where he's on the air when Robin Williams gets taken off the air, and he's constantly honk, honk, honk with a horn, thinks that's funny. And of course, it's not, and that's the joke. And Bruno Kirby's funny because he's not funny. Fozzie's kind of the same in this, except there's that great line when he's doing his third performance ever in the El Slizo Cafe. The sailor was so fat, smash, how fat was he? He was so fat that there was nothing funny about him at all.
He is just so earnest. I mean, they're all very earnest.
Yes, sir.
A year and a half ago, a friend of ours turned 50 and another friend of ours threw her a Muppet theme party because she loved Miss Piggy.
It was time to light the lights.
Yes, and so she asked each of us who were attending the party to pick our favorite Muppet. And
Fozzie.
I was like, oh, I better respond quickly because everyone's going to pick Gonzo. I was wrong. But I was surprised that of the six of us, there were no arguments. We all just individually had a favorite Muppet. It was Animal. It was a Swedish Chef. It was Fozzie for you, Gonzo for me, Miss Piggy for Kelly, and Kermit. You could think of many more that are just as individually lovable and wonderful. One of the main appeals of the Muppet Show. That
not Sweetums.
Not Sweetums?
Sweetums freaked me out when I was young when I first saw this film.
He was kind of scary.
Maybe because it's the full-body Muppet.
Yeah, I think so.
It's clearly a tall guy in a suit. You do see all of Kermit and Fozzie a few different times in this movie, and it's unusual, but they're still cute. They're not intimidating.
He's scary even in the opening. His gait, the way he walks.
I don't feel scared by him now, incidentally. I just mean when I was, whatever age I was when I first saw this movie. And maybe he was on the show. I don't recall now.
Oh,
I saw
definitely was.
Okay, I saw the show way more than I ever saw the movies. I don't know that I've seen all of the movies the Muppets have been in. If I have, I can't remember seeing the space one. I've seen Great Muppet Caper and Muppets Take Manhattan. I think the Christmas one, Christmas Carol, Muppet Christmas Carol, a few times a piece, but not in a long time. So anyway, Sweetums did freak me out. But Fozzie's the best one. So, the Jim Henson Story, which is what this really was released by AFD, a film company that put out the Muppet movies. Also, Sophie's Choice is a movie they had a hand in. And also Universal, so a major studio, 40 years ago, on June 22nd, 1979. What a big year that was. Apocalypse Now, Kramer vs. Kramer, Alien. It made people happy to the tune of $65 million. That's unadjusted money. $65 million back in 1979. So Bev, explain the movie. Remind people, really, what it's about with the Muppet movie, Skitty.
Kermit the Frog is going to Hollywood to spread happiness to the world. And on his way, he makes some friends like Fozzie Bear, Gonzo, and the beautiful Miss Piggy, who join him for his journey. But their trip is impeded by Doc Hopper, the operator of a Frog's Legs restaurant, who is uniquely determined to get Kermit to be its mascot.
Frog's Legs restaurants. Would there really be a need for a chain of those in America?
Have you ever eaten Frog's Legs?
I don't think so.
I did once when I was a kid. My parents told us they were chicken wings and then told us after. But
were they like chicken?
They tasted exactly like chicken wings. We were traveling. I can't remember where we were, but we were somewhere in Southeast Asia. It was a French restaurant in Southeast Asia. I can't remember. Anyway, we got tricked into eating frog's legs and they tasted just like chicken.
Well, Doc Hopper is a knockoff of Colonel Sanders. That's very deliberate, right down to the white outfit. But the food that Colonel Sanders gives us is something that can be mass-produced so much easier than I think frogs would be. And again, is there really a market for that as a chain?
If there was a market, they would find a way to produce them just the way they'd produce chicken wings.
Okay.
Think about, for every two chicken wings, a chicken has to be raised from egg.
But they use the rest of the chicken.
I know, but they would use the rest of the frog somehow, I suppose.
What about frog bellies? Oh, sheesh. Or, in a nutshell, green felt book. Which was also a road movie.
Well done.
This is a road movie? That was a road movie. And we did Green Book a couple of months ago. Okay, so the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. Same for audiences and critics. 88%. Bit of a surprise.
That low.
Deb did a bit of a Muppet face there in reaction to that. 44 fresh, 6 rotten reviews for an average of 8 out of 10. I'm surprised that the numbers were that good, actually. You were surprised they were that high. I thought they might be a little bit lower, so I was glad to see that.
I'm surprised they weren't higher.
Okay, if I didn't say that's what I meant. You thought they'd be higher. I thought they might be a little bit lower than that. Not bad, just not 88 and 88.
Especially
and
audience members. I thought audience would be closer to 100.
The movie was 10th at the 1979 U.S. box office. And I mentioned Kramer vs. Kramer, Apocalypse Now, Alien. They were 1, 4, and 6 that year at the box office. And China Syndrome, which we covered a few months ago, was 23rd. When you adjust for inflation, this movie of the 8 Muppet flicks that have been made is number 1. And Muppets in 2011, the Jason Segel one that he wrote and co-starred in, is number 2 adjusted for inflation. This movie got nominated for 2 Oscars, the song, the one that you're going to talk about in a minute you didn't like, The Rainbow Connection, and the music score by Paul Williams and Kenny Asher. They didn't win either one of those. Norma Rae won for its song and All That Jazz won for the music score. And this movie made the National Film Registry, so it's being protected by Congress. That was in 2009, so a 30-year anniversary for them when they made that grouping, whatever you want to call it, Dog Day Afternoon. And Once Upon a Time in the West, we covered both of those. They both were inducted into the NFR that same year. And also, the Muppet Movie was nominated for the top 25 musicals on the AFI list, the top 100 laughs, and the top 100 songs with the one that you don't like. All right, so I just said it. You don't love the song. So tell us what you thought about the song itself and then the movie as a whole, the Muppet Movie.
Okay. I don't like the Rainbow Connection.
What?
I hate it. Even when I was a kid, I hated it. First of all, as a child, I wondered, what are all these songs that Kermit is talking about?
I'm going to interrupt you. I prepared for this knowing you'd say this.
Come on, no. If you couldn't have thought of them off the top of your head, it does not count. You Googled a list of
Sing
songs
a rainbow,
about rainbows.
She's a Rainbow. Of course, Over the Rainbow. Rainbow Interlude, Mariah Carey. Rainbow Land, Miley Cyrus.
A lot of these songs came out after the Muppet movie.
Colors of the Rainbow. A Pocket Full of Rainbows by Elvis. Your point. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My point is, truly, there's one song about rainbows and what's on the other side that is popular, and that's Over the Rainbow, which was 40 years old when this movie came out. It's not some sweeping phenomenon, ubiquitous in our culture, as he implies. But mostly, even as a child, I found this song cloying with this asinine sentimentalism about indulging in wishful thinking.
Oh, sheesh.
Perhaps proof that I was born a black-hearted cynic. And maybe it would have worked better for me if it was coming from a character like Fozzie, or just anyone other than Kermit, who's kind of the most grounded and pragmatic Muppet. And I will finish by saying that this opinion has never been seconded by anyone I have ever expressed it to. I stand alone in my hatred of the Rainbow Connection.
If I may quote Miss Piggy, I will say, hi-ya!
Yes. Yes, you can join
the
chorus the
frog.
Of people who are mad at me
Respect
about
the Rainbow frog.
Connection. And then as a movie as a whole, unfortunately, as I said, I do have a cold, dead heart. As I've mentioned many times on the podcast before, I'm allergic to nostalgia. So as sweet and creative and funny and earnest as the Muppet movie is, it's still a kid's movie. And for me, as an adult, it has diminishing results. Most of the cameos were designed to delight our parents and are still obscure to me now that I'm the age my parents were when this movie came out, or even older. While the jokes are timeless, characters have universal appeal, and as children's programming, it has few equals, but I would never choose to watch this personally. And this is another opinion of mine that is extremely unpopular with my peers.
Your thoughts are a little bit scattered all over the place. You seem like you didn't like it, then you seem like you did.
Oh, no, I'm just acknowledging it is a very good movie. I loved it as a kid, and I can recognize all the things about it that make it great for children, but I am a heartless adult with no joy in my heart.
We saw this movie with those friends you mentioned earlier at that party. The movie was playing. I think we caught it maybe 20 minutes in. It was one of those things where they just had it muted in the background. We all sat down and watched it. I think from that point on.
Yeah, it's true. We did watch most of it together.
Quoting it or making fun of it. One thing about the Muppets in general, and this movie especially, that I think goes against the whole thing about it being for kids, because it is, but it also has a Looney Tunes-esque wise-ass sense of humor. And a lot of the jokes and those cameos would go way above kids' heads. So you get the James Coburns of the world, who I didn't know when I first saw this film, which would have been probably the mid-80s. He's one of the first of the cameos. I guess the very first one is Dom DeLuise, who's pretty good as Bernie the Agent. I think the best actors, because some of them are on screen for a matter of minutes. Madeline Kahn might have been hilarious, but she's on the screen for seconds. I rewatched the El Slizo sequence, and that's got five celebrities. Coburn is the owner, gets thrown out of the bar in the beginning, has a couple of lines. Madeline Kahn has even less screen time than he does. Telly Savalas is about the same amount he does. Carol Kane appears more than once because she's got the whole myth running
gag.
Yeah,
she's a recurring joke.
Mm-hmm. And then Paul Williams, who's the composer of this movie, if you want to call him a celebrity, is also in there too. But five of the cameos, and there's a lot of cameos in this movie, if you don't want to include Williams, then four of them, are in a matter of minutes in that one sequence. And all those names were way above my head. I don't think I knew who Mel Brooks was back then, certainly as a face. No, I didn't know Mel Brooks anyway, back when I first saw the film. So I think that's why it's not really just a kid's movie, and a lot of the jokes, I wouldn't say that they're bawdy, the way The Simpsons can sometimes be, even Pixar can sometimes be. So yes, they're for kids, but I think what makes them work is that wise-ass Looney Tunes sense of humor, and they love their puns.
I like the meta stuff, which seems to me in 79 was probably relatively new and gutsy.
Breaking up the script.
Breaking up the script. Yeah, they do some pretty self-referential stuff, but the most meta thing they do is giving the script itself to Dr. Teeth's band.
And that's how he finds them later on, because he read the script.
It's such a cool touch, and it feels like something that in 1979 was probably pretty gutsy.
Well, the movie's also meta because it opens with the Muppets themselves watching the movie they made. So we know they made it to Hollywood and succeeded because they're watching their own movie. And I'm going to skip ahead to the What Happens Next. Now, we know there are sequels. In a way, they're just the cast in another version of the movie. Because I believe in other movies, Kermit and Piggy have their meet-cute. So they can't possibly be true sequels when they've already met Cute in this one. And of course they met each other before this on the TV show. So anyway, they had other movies, we know that. But just discounting that, I feel like Kermit is bound to get more directing work based on his entertaining short film. And why I say short film is that he is the director of the movie that we're watching here. But we only see about a 3-minute sequence, if that. It's just this whole mashed together thing of what we saw. Unless you were supposed to argue that the movie that they're watching, that we're watching, is what he shot. And I guess you could. But when we see them in the actual studio, Worldwide Studios,
with their sets,
that's a couple of minutes of screen time. So he's going to have to be like David Fincher, one of those kinds of guys. Let's get him into feature work because he's only done a short film. But anyway, that's what happens next, I think. And of course, they did go on to make other movies. If we didn't already say Jim Henson, he, of course, is the Muppet brainchild for all of this. Frank Oz was one of his partners, I think, all along. Frank Oz is the immortal voice of Yoda, of course, and so many other characters. But in this series, Piggy and Fozzie are his two most famous ones. Also Animal, Sam the Eagle. I won't name all the names. But Oz also directed Bowfinger, which is 20 years old, one of my favorite comedies of 1999. And then Jerry Nelson, Richard Hunt, Dave Gels or Goels, G-O-E-L-Z. Those names are all in the cast list as puppeteers and voices. Steve Whitmire is a guy who took over for Jim Henson when he died in 1990 at only 50 years old. Jim Henson died way too young. And Whitmire became the voice of Kermit. He sounds close enough to Henson. It's not quite the same thing. And also, apparently, John Landis and Tim Burton, big name directors in the future. John Landis had directed already at that point. Tim Burton hadn't, but they're also puppeteers. And this is Henson's thing. It started as a TV thing. I guess it was first on Sesame Street, I think.
Yeah, he started on Sesame
Street. Then they spun off the Muppet Show, which won multiple Emmys. And then this movie, Great Muppet Caper, which I saw in the theater. I think that might have been the first thing I ever saw. Maybe it was the Muppet Show, but it was definitely that movie before I ever saw this movie. And that's also how I can say that obviously there can't be a sequelized thing because I would have really lost. Oh my God, I'm lost with the Muppets. But it's just that the characters are recast. It's not that they're literally sequels to each other. So Jim Henson was in a steel drum during the opening sequence of this movie, operating Kermit, and you see his legs, just like you see when he rides the bike later on, when he leaves the swamp to go to try to get to Hollywood. Henson insisted that you see his legs a few times, so you do right off the bat, and you also see in the El Slizo Cafe, so the first 20 or 30 minutes of the movie, you see Kermit full body 3 different times, sitting on the log in the swamp, riding the bike in El Slizo, dancing with Fozzie, which is a fun and cute sequence too. A lot of people were amazed by that. It's kind of like the whole thing Superman had come out the year before. You will believe a man can fly. Well, on this, you will believe a frog can ride a bike. What do you think about some of those kinds of things? Because that was big for the Muppets to have full body with Kermit and Fozzie and Kermit multiple times.
One of my biggest memories about this movie when it came out was my parents being very impressed by the bike scene. We must have watched it at home. I mean, I was born in 78, so it was definitely in home media in some way by the time I was a kid, or at least on TV. And I remember them being impressed, and then as a young kid, it being this early example of a feat of engineering, which is exactly what it is. A lot of things, a lot of special effects in film. I think that's what the Muppets, one of the things they deserve credit for, their world building, their character building is obviously their biggest achievement, but they elevated puppetry. I don't even know if it's ever met that since then.
In our movie next week, we talk about puppetry in that. That's a fantasy as well, bigger than this, really.
Yeah, but actually, it's pretty interesting. These movies came back to back. What do you
think?
Wasn't
really intentional.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. Being John Malkovich is our next film that we're doing.
Well, that's like Alien. Again, no digital effects back in 1979, the same year as this movie. So much practical stuff that's so believable.
It's funny, I was going to use the metaphor. You can see the strings, but you actually can't technically see the strings. When they're doing the dance scene, you can just see that it's clearly done on a blue screen. But when they're doing the bike riding, I cannot see the strings. It is so smooth. They really polished it to a level where you are, when you're watching it, not thinking about how did they do that. You're just caught up in the story and enjoying each scene on its own.
I'm talented. Well, speaking of the people behind the puppets, because they're the real masters here, and obviously Jim Henson and Frank Oz were the two main ones and had the big voices, Kermit, Piggy, Fozzie, Animal, and so many others. But a little guy drove the car from the trunk, because there's a lot of road scenes in this. It is Green Felt Book, and the car is being driven by somebody in the trunk. Now, obviously, you don't have to worry about traffic, because you're going to shut down the road, but Kermit and Fozzie, and then later on Gonzo and Piggy and Camilla are all in that car at one time. I think that's the extent of it, isn't it? Well, then again, they're all on a bus later on, but most of the movie is Kermit and Fozzie in that car. And the puppeteers are just hidden in the car, just low on it. I'm sure that if you saw outtakes, you'd see them pop their heads up. Well, James Frawley, I didn't say his name yet, the director, who never worked with the Muppets again. This was his fourth of five movies as a director. He was a big TV director, did a lot of that. Nearly every show on television in the 70s and 80s, and maybe even the 90s, seemed to have his name on it at one time or another as a director. And he was involved with the Monkees as well. But he didn't work with the Muppets again. And I guess he and Henson didn't really get along all that well. It's funny because Jim Henson, you think of as the creator of this, and he is. But he only directed three movies in his entire career, including The Dark Crystal, which has been made into a TV series now. I watched The Dark Crystal on Netflix about, I don't know, 2 months ago. And I saw it when I was a young kid. I think in the theater, same year I saw E.T. I didn't see a lot of movies in the theater back then. But I know I saw those two in 1982. And I didn't love The Dark Crystal, although the puppeteering is incredible. It advanced so much from this movie, which was 3 years before. But Henson wasn't really a director per se. Maybe he directed on TV. I didn't look at that. But he didn't really direct films. He didn't even get writing credit on this. That was Jerry Jewell, J-U-H-L, and Jack Burns. Jewell won Emmys for The Muppet Show and also for Sesame Street. And the only screenplay Burns ever wrote was this one.
But Jim Henson gets credit for creating the entire world. He was a big collaborator. He put a lot of faith in the people who worked with him, particularly Frank Oz, who I saw described as, in his time, one of the greatest living puppeteers there was, and created some of the most iconic characters there are. And Henson had this reputation as someone who created a really open atmosphere where you could take risks in a way. The farther you went with the character, the more he liked it. So it is curious that he had disputes with the director. Maybe it was a matter of control. He is used to controlling the directors that he worked with on the show. Here he had somebody who was just as used to being in control of their projects.
Yeah, I didn't read specifics of why they didn't get along, but I guess it was Henson's project for all he's a director for hire, but still pushed back against that. Henson was the actual producer with Lou Grade as an executive producer, and then he's honored as Lou Lord. That's Orson Welles' character. Gotta love Orson Welles and his small cameo in this.
Maybe the second best cameo.
Well, it's such great casting for a lot of reasons. First is Orson Welles, who was still a legend. He was always a legend, even when he started doing real bad shit. He'd been doing bad shit, either acting, I guess not really directing, but acting so much, voiceover work for so long. It was pretty much just a paycheck for him. I'm sure this was too. Although, a lot of the actors we talked about already, and we'll probably talk about some more of them, had been on the show before. Probably Steve Martin, I'm guessing, because he was one of the bigger names in this. Well, I guess Milton Berle was a big name too, Mel Brooks. But anyway, Welles plays Lou Lord, based on Lou Grade. He looks at the Muppets for 8 seconds and then says, prepare the standard rich and famous contract, which is funny. But what's great about having him as the big studio executive is that ironically, maybe fittingly is a better word, is he had to beg studio heads himself, much like Kermit and these guys had to do, or these people had to do. Oh, that's another thing I'll get into in 1 second. Guys. But you get to that point after I finish this one, which is that I love that notion that Welles is a studio head. I get to call the shots. Also, the Muppets are like his Mercury Theater. Give him the keys to his studio. That's what these guys get. That's what he got when he went to Hollywood to make Citizen Kane. And that made everybody angry. We talked about that podcast many years ago. Okay, I just said it. We talked about this in the subway a couple of days ago. You're not a fan of the Muppets for another reason.
Tell us why. I'm not a fan of the Muppets, okay? Even though I loved them when I was a kid, I don't have a particularly strong nostalgic attachment to them. And I will acknowledge the genius and the miracle of this earnest, sweet, and hilarious, unique thing that is the Muppets. I'm not mad at them, and by no means do I want to cancel the Muppets. And I understand that the 70s was a different time. But I realized recently, when we went to that delightful Muppet-themed party where our friend asked us to pick a favorite Muppet, I knew that our friend Kelly would pick Miss Piggy, and it was her birthday, so oh, maybe I'll pick another female Muppet. That's when I realized in this team of immensely creative men, they could imagine Gonzo, Animal, Dr. Bunsen and Beaker, Sweetums, Fozzie. They could not imagine more than one female Muppet. And I know that a few of you are thinking, wasn't there a woman in the band? Yeah. And if you can remember her name.
Janis Joplin.
That's cheating. That came up recently, or maybe, anyway. You can count that for half, because you can remember her name. But she rarely did anything more than play music and have bangs.
Can you picture that? The Electric Mayhem!
You can add Camilla, Gonzo's voiceless hen girlfriend, and you've summed up all of the regular female Muppets in the regular cast. And the production did nothing to seek out female puppeteers or performers to voice them or create characters. The female characters got performed kabuki style by the all-male cast. Even worse than the Muppets is Sesame Street, which when we were children had no female main character Muppets. Not a single one. It has improved in that now has 2 of the 8. But it's more harmful because this is a show that was marketed towards even younger children. this wouldn't be egregious if, say, Muppets was a show for boys exclusively, like G.I. Joe, but it wasn't. Or if it was a show for adults and not children who are building their worldview and looking for characters like themselves to affirm their place in the world, but it was. Or if there were lots of shows out there with an opposite dynamic, you know, with majority female characters or the token male, there wasn't. As a matter of fact, most children's programming followed this formula. It's the Smurfette syndrome. I thought I invented that, but I actually looked this up and there is something called the Smurfette syndrome. There's a character to represent every type of personality, and a woman is one of them. It's a phenomenon in Hollywood that's so pervasive that casting directors even cast way more men than women in crowd scenes as extras, and it's insidious, and it's harmful, and it contributes to the idea that male is default, which then contributes to all kinds of conscious and subconscious biases. Of course, when I watched The Muppets as a little girl, I had yet to be indoctrinated into the world of feminism, but in the interim, my eyes have been open, and it's kind of spoiled The Muppets for me. And I want to repeat, I am not trying to get The Muppets canceled. It was the 70s. I am not mad. I'm hurt. I don't know how else to describe this feeling except by saying I'm heartbroken that this sweet, creative gift to children really treated my gender like a deviation instead of what we are, which is half of all of human experience. And there's no doubt that collectively, along with all the other media that was happening at the time and long before that, that oversight did harm. End of rant.
I heard this a few days ago. I didn't argue against what you said then, but I'll bring up what I said on the subway at that point, was that I think, and I know this isn't okay, you're going to say it's not okay as an answer, but Jim Henson and Frank Oz and the rest of them would have worked with people that they knew. They're going to hire people they trust. That's probably why people hire white people if they're white, or men if they're men. Although you hear that women who are bosses also hire men more often than they do women, or at least they have in the past. I know that's not okay, but I think that's probably the excuse for it. There probably were a lot of women puppeteers. I don't know. I don't know much about puppeteering. There probably were, well, we learned eventually that the guy who did Elmo, Kevin Clash, I don't think he was around at this point. He was still pretty young, but he's a black guy. I'm not sure he's even doing the job anymore because he got in a scandal of his own.
Yeah, he's a sex pest.
A delightful movie that we saw at the Hot Docs Film Festival many years ago, the Being Elmo documentary.
Moments before he got busted, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'll say that probably part of the reason that Jim Henson, when he was hiring his team and creating this warm, wonderful environment for creatives to create this amazing world, part of the reason that he only surrounded himself with men was probably because he himself grew up consuming media where men were default. Mm-hmm. And women were extras. They were girlfriends. They were tokens. This is where it is an insidious problem. And that's okay, why I don't get mad at Henson. It's not his fault. He seems like an overwhelmingly lovely human being. And if he was creating The Muppet Show in 2019, I don't doubt that it would be a very different environment. You can't have this kind of earnestness and sweetness and not be open to different voices if it would have ever occurred to you in the first place. But I think your point more points out how an environment like this almost accidentally indoctrinates people to continue this system. I guess a counterpoint to all of it, Miss Piggy is the best female character. She is so awesome because she is beautiful and glamorous
and
confident and hilarious, and she's the best fighter of all the Muppets. She's actually kind of similar to Princess Leia. Okay, well, if you're going to only have one woman in your entire universe,
Leia's the best shot in Star Wars.
You really do make her.
Leia does not miss.
Like, the coolest, best character in the entire universe. And that's like Miss Piggy, where, of course, she's narcissistic and she's ridiculous at times, but she's just so funny and lovable and she brings so much life. She's just one of those characters when she's on screen, you can't take your eyes off of her. She's always the star of any scene that she's in. So that's a kind of little antidote to that other problem.
Well, we first meet her at the fair. So Gonzo and Camilla are now with Kermit and Fozzie on their road trip. So we see her at the fair. She wins the beauty pageant, which is great because she's up against humans. It's just one puppet and it's her. She loves Kermit at first sight. Kermit! And she sings a song about him. But you just talked about what's so great about her, because in that one sequence where she attacks all those guys and wins against all of them, like I said, Bruce Lee style, one little person can defeat all these other, well, not a person, puppet, can defeat all these guys. But then, of course, the phone. Yeah, Morty, what do you got? I can't do a very good Piggy. Commercial. Oh, okay. Goodbye.
After all that, she still would pick her career and herself over Kermit.
Which is funny.
It's so funny.
It might be mean, but it's funny. And of course, the date where Steve Martin is the insolent waiter, as it says online here. But it's a pretty long date, and she leaves Kermit in the first place. I'd forgotten. I thought that's where she actually got the job. But they had kidnapped her, and that's why she didn't come back when they're both enjoying that very cheap bottle of wine. Do you like to smell the bottle cap? Steve Martin. But before we even got to that fair, to meet Piggy, and it's Fozzie and Kermit on the road for a while, they meet the Electric Mayhem in that church in the middle of nowhere, playing music for no one, I guess, until a frog and a bear come along. They paint the car, they play a few songs, then the car gets an accident with Gonzo, and then they trade in for a Woody. That's a fun sequence, too, because Sweetums accidentally gives him this great deal when he smashes a fly and makes, what is it, $1,999 into $1,999. And then Milton Berle gets screwed out. He's the one that says, oh, prices are final. But one thing I'd forgotten again is that Gonzo is a plumber, the Prince of Plungers.
His nose does look like a pipe.
That's true. An elbow pipe. Well, when the movie does get plotty, it's because, of course, of Doc Hopper. He kidnaps Piggy, and then they get out of that sequence. But then at the end, we're in the old West town. Kermit's got his cowboy hat on. When Animal breaks through the roof, that was not a miniature that they shot and then composited. Apparently, that was a real giant animal head.
What?
Seems like a waste of money, doesn't it? But that's actually what it was.
It looks so awesome. I think as a kid, I was equally scared and thrilled by it. If I feel nostalgia about anything, that scene is one of them. It made such a big impression.
But he does manage to get back to normal size. Bunsen Honeydew and Beaker are the ones that accidentally make him... Well, actually, no. I guess Animal just takes this pill or what was it? Something that was in...
I don't remember.
Was it Bunsen actually was making the pill? Or am I forgetting now? The movie gets a little plotty at that point, I guess. And speaking of scientists and medicine and everything, I skipped over Mel Brooks' part. He's probably got the second longest amount of screen time of the humans. Well, of the cameoing humans, not Charles Durning as Doc Hopper, who's pretty good in this. We've covered him in Dog Day Afternoon, and he's in Tootsie. Not him and Austin Pendleton, who is his assistant. But of the cameoing people, Steve Martin probably has the most screen time, and the second most would likely be Mel Brooks. And his stuff is over the top and not very good, quite honestly.
Yep.
He's not very funny.
And Mel Brooks has not aged well to me.
Ribbit! Kind of lame. One thing that was nice before we even got to that end sequence where Animal saves the day in the Old West town, and Kermit tries to talk sense to Doc Hopper. Why are you doing this? Leave me alone. My friends and I just want to get to Hollywood. But Rolf around the campfire says, we blew it. And I wonder if that's supposed to be an homage to Easy Rider, because around a campfire in Easy Rider, Peter Fonda says to Dennis Hopper, we blew it. I think he says it more than once. And there's all kinds of stories. I think we talked about that in that podcast years ago, but what that really meant to Fonda. In this movie, I'm sure it's just an homage. They didn't really blow anything. We know they succeeded anyway.
This only came out 10 years after Easy Rider, so it was probably still fresh in people's minds. Another movie we've covered that came out around the same time, I think in 1980s, Lost in America, where they talk about Easy Rider all the time.
85. We covered that a couple years ago.
Oh, 85. Okay, so it was still fresh in the public's mind 16 years later, so you know it was still culturally relevant in 79. Another one of those little references, cultural references, that they put in there for the adults.
I think we covered that last fall, Lost America. Funny movie. Before we get into the more of the technical people and then wrap up, I have to say how much I actually really noticed more than ever how Statler and Waldorf are actually fun. Much like Fozzie, their jokes aren't really all that funny. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. A lot of dad jokes. But what I really noticed this time is how often they always laughed at each other's jokes.
Yeah,
it's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
I've seen better film on teeth. One of the oldest lines in the world. But when somebody else laughs at it, it's funny. It's like Fozzie's act. When I watched it again today, the El Slizo thing, not funny. Waka, waka, waka. But he's so charming and lovable that it is funny. During the end sequence, apparently there are 250 Muppets.
Yeah.
And they got every puppeteer in the world they could possibly find.
Yeah, there was like 170 people or something underneath that floor, most of them operating two puppets.
I guess that's probably an homage then at the end of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, although that was mostly digital. I guess some of it would have been, oh, not digital really, right?
No, but probably was classical.
Right, so all classical animation where you had all kinds of animated characters in the scene on the screen at the end of that one. Just to get back to your rant about the lack of females in the Muppets, Carol Kane and Madeline Kahn are back-to-back, Kane and Kahn, two of the funnier women who've ever been on screen, especially Madeline Kahn. There's somebody who didn't get enough work, really. We were going to cover Young Frankenstein next month. We decided to change it to something else, but she is one of those people, and I mentioned this to you a few days ago, like Kate McKinnon on SNL now, who is, of course, really funny and a little whacked in a great way, but is also beautiful. Mm. She's got the ability of somebody who could be a leading person, although I think in both Khan and McKinnon's cases, these people are too interesting and weird to ever really be leading ladies. I've said before about Kate McKinnon, I don't want to see her do some rom-com, and maybe she never will at this point. She's not exactly 25 anymore, but do some rom-com in a movie where she can't find a man, because she's better than that. And she's stranger than that. And I mean that completely as a compliment. And Madeleine Kahn was the 70s version, in a lot of ways, of Kate McKinnon. So you only see her for a few seconds, but at least you get two of the funnier people back-to-back of the lady cameos. And then Cloris Leachman is Lou Lord's secretary.
So on that note, I actually looked up all the cameos because I was curious about the ratio of men to women. And yeah, you just named three great, talented women up against the 16 men who make cameos in the film. So the ratio still pretty off. Sorry to mess with your point.
That doesn't mess with my point. I'm just bringing up that Madeleine Kahn was extraordinarily talented and never really hit stardom, and probably couldn't have because she wasn't your average leading lady of the 70s. And maybe not quite as dramatically talented as a Jane Fonda was back then. But man, could she steal scenes. And when she left the scene in El Slizo, it's almost like, get her back here. Give her more to do.
We never come back to her. She's very brief.
Telly Savalas, too, in that same scene, is only on the screen for a matter of seconds. You don't see much of Richard Pryor as one of the funniest people who's ever lived. He's a balloon salesman. The one that gives Gonzo the balloons where he's flying off in the sky. He's only on the screen for a matter of seconds as well. All right, we talked about James Frawley, the director, and the writers, and Jim Henson, of course, his producer, and really the overseer of this whole thing. Isidore Menkovsky shot the movie. It was 185:1, and we own the DVD. He's a journeyman, did a lot of TV. I thought he did fine. It probably can't be easy to light puppets, although I suppose they're inanimate. You don't have to worry about having a stand-in. Just let the puppet be lit. But to make that work with both humans and puppets. And also, credit to anyone who's ever worked with puppets. And the Muppets over the years, of course, are such a ubiquitous part of culture for over 40 years now. But to make sure that you're looking the right place. Now, then again, you probably wouldn't see Jim Henson or Frank Oz. Maybe you would underneath where the camera can't pick it up. But you're going to look at the eyes of the puppet. I remember reading somewhere that George Lucas, I think it was, or maybe one of the directors of the Star Wars sequels, the original three, at one point talking to Yoda, was talking to Yoda and not to Frank Oz.
Don't you think you would do that,
though? I probably would, too.
In preparation for the podcast, I watched this great 60 Minutes piece that they did. It was just this 10-minute bit about the Muppet Show when it was becoming popular in the 70s. They sent one of their correspondents to set, and he was like, I couldn't talk to the puppeteers. Like, I just talked to the puppets. They were the ones with these huge personalities. And when they talk to you, they're just so realistic that you treat them like they're real. We actually, on the show that I work on, we had Miss Piggy as a guest. And it was remarkable just how much life there is in that puppet. And all the hosts were talking to her. It doesn't feel like it's weird. You see it all the time with puppets interacting with people. Another remarkable thing about watching that show is you get to see the puppets at work. They would go into a wide shot and you would see the scene, but with the puppeteers in the shot. I don't know how anybody physically does what they do for as long as they do it. Their arms are up in the air. Mm-hmm. Those puppets are not always light either. And they are doing take after take after take with nothing in my hand. My arm would get tired after like 2.5 minutes.
Usually both hands too.
Yes! There is quite a bit of physical endurance involved in this, but they're just some of the most dedicated, passionate performers there are, and I'm sure there's plenty written. I've seen like a great documentary once about the life of a puppeteer and how it really is almost a lifestyle. They really express their personalities through these bigger-than-life creatures that they create, and it allows you to express madness in your most wild side.
The editor, Chris Greenberry, cut American Beauty, so he got nominated for an Oscar for that many years later, 20 years later as it turns out, and worked a lot with the Farrelly brothers on their comedy, so he obviously knows comedy quite well with those movies and those credits. The composer I mentioned already, Paul Williams and Kenny Asher. Williams was nominated for 6 Oscars in the 70s, won one of them. That was for, I believe, Evergreen from A Star Is Born, the song, and then Asher worked primarily with Williams. So what do you think of the look, the cutting, and that music score? You didn't love the song. What about the music in general, the score? Because I think a lot of the songs in this actually could have been nominated for Oscars or maybe even the AFI list. The other songs, too. Can You Picture That's a Fun Song? The one that Piggy sings to Kermit.
I like all the other songs, and I think the score is really cute, appropriate, cheerful, really works with the film. Technicals, they're great. Maybe isn't the most inspired-looking film, but the puppets are the star. So for something like this, I don't really need the cinematography to be out of this world. It can be work a day, get the shot.
Just don't show the strings.
Just don't show the strings.
And they didn't exactly. Really.
Yeah. But considering how hard it must have been, they really make it look easy. Let's put it that way.
So this movie was spun off of the beloved TV show that ran for only 5 seasons. I thought it would have been longer than that. In the mid-70s, I believe it was, till the early 80s. It was rebooted for 1 year in 2015. I didn't watch. I guess I'm like a lot of people that would say I'm a big fan, but didn't even give it a chance. But then again, Jim Henson not being part of it, as he obviously wasn't. I don't think Frank Oz was either. It'd be hard to feel like it's the same thing. Frank Oz hasn't done Piggy or Fozzie, those characters, I think, in a long time. I don't believe he's been involved in the two newer ones they made in 2011, the reboot that was co-written and co-starring Jason Segel, 2011. That was a hit. And then its sequel, which did not do well, Muppets Most Wanted. I've only ever seen that once. I probably should watch it again. Tina Fey's in that, though, and yeah. I remember her doing her best.
All the cameos now are meant to appeal to people our age. If we had kids, it would be our kids that would be watching these movies. So they put in all these stars and all these little jokes just for us, but apparently it wasn't very good. I saw the 2011 Jason Segel Muppet movie. To be honest, it left me cold. I didn't hate it, but I just felt nothing, but I forgot it almost immediately after I saw it.
I enjoyed it. That won the Oscar for the Muppet or a Man song, which is a great sequence. You really need to see that, though, where they play off the puppet, the Muppet, whatever, and the actual character, Walter,
of course. I was delighted by that because the song was written by Brit from Flight of the Conchords. Mm-hmm.
So there have been 8 Muppet movies in total, 5 sequels to this. And again, they're not really necessarily sequels per se, but just redoings of these characters, recastings, almost like a Bond movie or something like that.
Ensemble.
All right, last thoughts on our first movie back after a week away in New Orleans. A little fun trifle called the Muppet Movie.
I think it is probably delightful to revisit this if you grew up with the Muppets. It holds up. It does truly an outstanding job of translating what was essentially a variety show into a feature film.
It was hard to spin off TV shows into movies back then. It wasn't done very often, so for this to have succeeded at all is saying something, and it was quite a hit in 1979. Not as important or meaningful as Apocalypse Now, Kramer vs. Kramer, Alien, and some other movies from that year, but a little kids movie before the year's over. Although, some of those jokes, not such a kids movie. It was a myth. Yes? All right, so Puppets this week and Puppets next week, because in 7 days we gave this away already, but we're going to cover another entry from the glorious year of 1999, Spike Jonze's Being John Malkovich. Malkovich, Malkovich, Malkovich. What a strange film this is. The coming attractions trivia for BJM. And this is an opinion thing again, but I think a really good one. If you could spend 10 or say 15 minutes inside of anyone's head, who would it be?
Oh my God.
Anybody.
Oh, I need to think about
that.
Let's
say just living, though. Not living or dead. Just living now.
Okay, so for the answer to that question, check out our next podcast about being John Malkovich. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and many, many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51, or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 20% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. And that's all one word, top100project, and it's not case sensitive.
Goodbye.
And cut.
Waka, waka, waka.